You're in power. Your first job is to make sure that you establish justice and deal with people with just fairness and equality, and do not differentiate yourself from them. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
صل يا ربي على طه الأمين رحمة أرسلته للعالمين وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of Al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam Al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad, and I'm invited by Brother Mahdi to this segment of the program. Today, I'd like to read to you a passage about Islamic lifestyle according to Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. This passage is extracted from a book titled The Life of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Baqir, written by the great Iraqi Muslim historian and scholar Allama Baqir Sharif al-Qurashi. This great Muslim scholar and historian was born in 1344 AH in the city of Najaf. He's well known for his books on the biography and conduct of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Please stay with me. Imam al-Baqir, peace be upon him, dispraised the hypocrite person who was double-faced and double-tongued. He, peace be upon him, said, "Bad is the servant who is double-faced and double-tongued. He flatters his brother when he is present. He backbites him when he is absent. He envies his brother when he is given something. He betrays him when he is afflicted by tribulation." These qualities denote that such a person has an evil soul, has no morals, and that he has no faith in his Lord.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about these beautiful dialogues, these great golden conversations that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam had throughout his life. Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, this divinely appointed imam, would be able to answer questions in such a simple manner, yet despite these answers being simple on the superficial level, we find that these answers were very profound, very complex, very beautiful, yet easy to understand. And so we find in one of these conversations that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam was asked, "Is there a thing better than gold?" Now, of course, even in today's age, we will find that gold, or let's say wealth or diamonds, these things are considered the absolute most precious things that you can own. Now, because this is 1,400 years ago, the most precious thing that an individual could own was gold. And so in today's time, you could also say that the most precious thing is gold. I mean, really, how many people have gold or diamonds or, let's say, billions of dollars? So here Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam is asked, what is more valuable than $1 billion? What is more valuable than gold? Imam al-Baqir answered, and I would really like everyone to pay attention to this. When asked, is there anything better than gold? Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam answers, yes, there is something better than gold. And that is the one who gives it. Allahu Akbar. An answer which I think nobody expected. The thing that is better than gold is the one who gives it away. In such a beautiful manner, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam has explained so many things to us in this very simple statement, in this very simple and short conversation with one of his companions. What is really the worth of this materialistic world? Two, what is the great importance of giving charity? And three, why should we fall in love with this materialistic wealth when it is better to just give it away on the path of Allah and for the sake of Allah? Three very simple things, and I guarantee you that if you sit and you reflect over this statement, what is better than gold? The one who gives it, you will find more doors of knowledge and wisdom will open. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
Ah. And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Saudagar.
To try to relate our condition to the conditions of Imam al-Baqir, see some parallels, although it's not exactly the same. We do have some differences here. But I'm going to focus on the similarities. And then look at Imam al-Baqir, salamullahi alayhi, what he presented. There's a methodology that he presented. The Imams stressed on this for that time onwards. So all the way until the end of the minor occultation, when Khulaini puts his book together, he is relying on a volume of resources, books of various scholars. Does he just take that book and narrate whatever's in it? Absolutely not. But this is the book of Hariz ibn Abdullah al-Sajistani, the student of Zurara ibn A'yan. Doesn't matter. That's what the book says, but there's this copy, there's the other copy, this one comes from this person, that comes from that person. The reason why the hadith book of Al-Kafi took 20 years to compile is not because the resources weren't there. It's because Khulaini is very careful. Where did this come from? Where did that come from? Now, if Khulaini did that, does that mean whatever he says? No, that doesn't mean if his judgment is that it's the saying of the Imam. Although this filters out a lot of stuff, that still doesn't mean it's necessary. There's still the process of ijtihad in looking at this. This is the teaching of Imam al-Baqir. Now, the process of ijtihad, identifying transmitters of hadith and so on and so forth, this is a difficult task. It's not something that we can just sit down and after maybe a couple days of discussion, a couple of hours each day, now like, okay, you can have the, for those who even know the Arabic language. That's not what we're suggesting. I'm giving you that background of hadith and also the knowledge that not all of our hadith are actually said by the Imams. If we have it even in our books, it doesn't necessarily mean that.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Abacus, Small Enough to Jail, directed by Oscar-nominated filmmaker Steve James. And joining me in the studio, we have Matthew Turner. He's a freelance film critic who writes for Vodzilla, iNews, and The List, among various other publications. And sitting next to him, we are also joined by political economist Clive Menzies, who is involved in Critical Thinking, a research and educational project which seeks to understand how the political economy works and identify levers for change. Now, this documentary centers on the Abacus Federal Savings Bank, a small American Chinese-owned family bank situated in Manhattan's Chinatown in New York City, which, because it was deemed small enough to jail rather than too big to fail, became the only financial institution to actually face criminal charges following the mortgage crisis in 2008. And born in Shanghai, Thomas Tsung founded Abacus Federal in 1984, hoping to make it easier for Chinese immigrants to get loans. And the bank eventually became a community hub, but in 2012, the Manhattan District Attorney's Office charged it with mortgage fraud, also indicting 19 of its former employees. And this film shows the Sun family fighting back against the charges and the toll it takes on them, as well as the Chinese community.
Today, we are announcing the indictment of the Federal Savings Bank on mortgage fraud, securities fraud, and conspiracy. A federally chartered bank that has been catering to the Chinese immigrant community since 1984.
If you are going to pick on a bank, family-owned company, wedged between a couple of noodle shops in Chinatown, is about as easy a target as you could possibly pick.
When I was a lawyer, there was no bank owned by Chinese and serving the Chinese.
When I walk around here, I feel very much at home. This is a very tasty noodle shop.
That's always special. That's the butt, isn't it?
When we were children, my dad was excited about this bank he was going to start.
We serve people who've never even dealt with the banking system before.
This whole ordeal began in 2009.
One of our loan officers stole money.
He was lying all over the place.
He was running a money laundering operation. I fired him that day.
They went straight to their regulator, and they told them about it.
The DA's office started asking us questions.
Wait a minute, maybe we're the target.
If that prosecution goes through, that bank is going to go out of business.
Although this is David versus Goliath, their whole family of lawyers.
We spent a lot of time investigating and ended up absolutely convinced that the loan department was corrupt through and through.
They routinely falsified mortgage documents.
Reporters in this town were treated to this extraordinary photo opportunity. This almost Stalinist-looking chain gang.
Herded like cattle down the hallway. I've been doing this for 25 years, and I'd never seen that happen.
Mommy's worried. Papa's 80 years old. He's been up since 5:30 a.m. He has nothing to eat for dinner. Let's get you some food. Papa, you do.
This is how he is. He's very calm, and I'm like a jumping bean, so I'm always running around.
You're going to eat now. You're older than a man, okay?
Abacus Federal Savings Bank had one of the nation's lowest default rates, not the highest, one of the lowest. Frankly, if every bank had underwritten as well as Abacus, we wouldn't have had a financial crisis.
People get the wrong impression that Chinese are not law-abiding.
This case is an attack on our community. We're easy prey.
Too big to fail turns into small enough to jail, and Abacus is small enough to jail.
Well, very well and welcome to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary, I think, gives a refreshing look at the banking crisis in that, unlike many documentaries and films in this subject, we get to see the more personal stories and the social impact the crash had. Now, Matthew, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on Abacus Small Enough to Jail?
Well, one of the most interesting things about it is we're used to seeing the big guy versus little guy stories, but the big guy is usually the bank. Like in this case, the little guy is the bank, and that sort of perspective, that sort of family-oriented perspective of it, is very interesting. I really enjoyed the film. I thought it was a strong story. Like, you care deeply about the family, you get to know them very well. The director, as you said, he made Hoop Dreams and he made the Roger Ebert documentary Life Itself, and he's very good at those sort of small, intimate family stories. And it's a very effective story, very well told. The court case stuff is interesting, if not perhaps quite as dramatic as you're maybe expecting. I mean, I don't think the outcome of the film is particularly in doubt, but it's still a very enjoyable, piece to watch.
And Clive, if I could turn to you, what was your take on the film? Would you agree with what Matthew said?
Yeah, I think it was a very good film as a story of itself, and I think they gave enough suggestion of this too big to fail versus small enough to jail. But to actually do that whole story justice is really two films, and maybe something like The Big Short and this together actually show you more of the picture.
And what did you make of Matthew's point that this dynamic between sort of the big guy not being the bank in this case, but the small guy?
Well, arguably the banks control the regulatory system anyway, so it's not really surprising. And our analysis would suggest that this was a targeted attempt to show that they were doing something about the crisis whilst quite willfully ignoring egregious crimes on a much larger scale.
And Matthew, as you were saying, you said that Steve James is good at telling personal family stories. In this documentary, though, it's quite politically charged. Do you think he was making a political statement?
I certainly think he was trying to. I mean, you have the press conferences and that Cyrus Vance, the DA, gives, where he's very sort of explicitly targeting the banks, whereas actually it's a very small bank and nothing really related to what you'd call Wall Street. And you have the quite extraordinary, the scene we just saw in the clip there with the chain gang, which is just really shocking anyway. And everybody interviewed in the film says that they've been working in this business 25 years or more and they've never seen anything like that. And the implication is they would never have done that to white bankers, black bankers, you know, anything like that.
Exonerating our entire community, no matter what we do, be it the little guy selling vegetables or a bank that's doing business. I told Mr. Song, I'm glad they pick on you because you're a fighter.
Cyrus Vance just felt this is easier to attack, especially as a family bank. But he doesn't realize Tom is not easy to be pushed around. And my girls, they're tough, smart, capable women, so courageous.
Although this is David versus Goliath, David being Abacus Federal Savings Bank has a slingshot. And that is, you know, their whole family of lawyers.
I was going to be able to fight this.
They're almost gleeful. They're like, we're going to have our day in court now. We're actually going to be able to show that they were wrong.
They made a decision that they were not going to plead guilty to something that they didn't feel the bank was guilty of. That is a courageous choice, and it's an expensive choice. The DA's office has hundreds of lawyers and took 5 years to do their grand jury investigations, and it is a daunting task to fight the government.
You could feel the enormous weight on their shoulders and the sort of stacks that are against them. Matthew, what did you make of their efforts of the Song family to fight back?
Well, the filmmaker Steve James picks up the. I guess he's come on board the story somewhere after the court case begins, and but before the result of the trial. So the cameras are actually there when the verdicts come in, you get a lot of the. You're not obviously allowed cameras inside the courtroom, but there's a lot of court reconstruction, so you have a feel for how the toll that the trial itself is taking on them. And yeah, I mean, as that clip showed, they're very sort of feisty characters, and they're all three of the women are lawyers, and they're really, yeah, they're very hungry for the fight, if you like. You don't really get a sense of how the investigation is going from the other side. You only see them and their efforts to sort of fight back and what they're doing as a family. You don't really get a sense of the DA's office. There are a couple of interviews with people who are involved in the DA's office, but they don't really tell you anything of great interest. Mm-hmm.
And Clive, would you agree? What did you make of the Song's family's challenges and their struggle to fight back against the DA? Do you think they were justified?
They were certainly justified. I suspect the DA were quite surprised at the strength of their fight back, because I think the Chinese community, or Chinese as a culture, are generally quite diffident and respectful of authority. And I think they hoped to actually ship them into pleading guilty, and they fail.
I mean, absolutely, there is a clip where Tom Sung, basically, he's offered a plea deal, and then they just says, no, I'm not going to take that plea deal. And it's really obvious that the DA's department thought they would just take that plea deal and, you know, all their problems would just magically go away. But no, that's,
they see this right all the way to the end.
They don't take the deal, exactly. And, I mean, as we say, it cost them $10 million, so another smaller business maybe wouldn't have been able to fight that the way they did.
Mm. And Clive, why was it then that, as the film claims, that Abacus was the only financial institution to actually face criminal charges following the 2008 financial crisis? You know, why don't we hear about major firms like Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, or Countrywide being held to account?
Could you imagine the outrage if you had Jewish bankers chained like they chained those employees? There's a very simple reason. The fraud that they're talking about in this film is nothing to do with the subprime crisis in terms of what crimes were actually committed, because the loan default rate on the Fannie Mae loans, the injured party was supposedly Fannie Mae, who made a lot of money out of this bank's loan book. And there were 9 defaults out of 3,000 mortgages. And actually, as it says in the film, their loan history was infinitely better than anyone else. Mm-hmm. What was happening in the subprime crisis is what people were packaging up garbage and selling it. There are stories of senior managers in Standard & Poor's, the credit rating agencies, being shouted at, being told to rate stuff, even though they didn't have the files on which to rate it. So there was this huge fraud, this creation of an illusion of some sort of quality in a mortgage book that was full of holes, mm-hmm. unlike Abacus Bank, which had really well-documented loans. Mm-hmm. Yes,
they had a case of a bad apple, but they fired the man who was giving out bad loans.
There is obviously a cultural element to this case, which is debt is as a construct, is a social construct in a community. If I'm related to you and I lend you money, whether you pay me back is much less important than if I've signed a piece of paper with someone. And that is a culture of this community. And you could argue that there was fraudulent documentation, but it wasn't obscuring what was actually going on in the way it was going on in the subprime crisis, where people who were never going to be able to pay it, they didn't have cash earnings on the side that they weren't declaring, they were never going to be able to repay these loans. And the people selling those mortgages knew that, and they bet against their clients at the same time. So the criminality of the system, which controls most of the regulation as well, is actually trying to use this little bank as some sort of flag waving that we're jailing bankers. The only country to jail bankers was Iceland, mm-hmm. and they jailed 28. Every other country capitulated. And this case had nothing to do with the subprime crisis.
I'm a former prosecutor. I'm not soft on crime. I've never seen a spectacle like this. These people were humiliated intentionally for no good reason.
It is not the district attorney's office's decision whether or not to put people in handcuffs, but people who were brought into court who have been charged with crimes are put into handcuffs. That's a decision that's made by the court officers. I won't go into it more than that because, you know, it's not something I'm involved with.
So in the film, we learn that the Abacus Bank plays an important role in the Chinese community. And we also find that it provides mortgages to immigrants who live sort of in a cash economy and have hidden assets. And we also learn more about Thomas Sung and his character in this film and his intentions, his noble intentions in starting the bank, as he believes that Chinese immigrants were being left out of the American dream. And what did you make of his character and his story?
Well, the film explicitly uses clips from Frank Capra's It's a Wonderful Life. The opening shot of the movie is Thomas Sung and his wife watching it and identifying very strongly with James Stewart's character, George Bailey, and particularly his position within the sort of small town community, what feels like a small town community, and helping people with small businesses. And he knows all the businesses, everybody knows who he is, and stuff like that. So there is very much that sort of man of the people element to Thomas Sung's story, I think.
And there's a scene in the documentary where we see that he's able to calm the crowds of all the clients who are rushing to get their money back, and he's able to soothe them.
Exactly like happens in It's a Wonderful Life. And in fact, the film shows clips of that exact same scene happening. It shows clips of George Bailey speaking to the crowd, preventing a run on the bank by telling them that your money's in his business and your money's in his business, and everybody's kind of helping each other. And you don't actually see Sung calming his own crowd, but he tells you have him telling the audience what he actually did, which is basically exactly the same thing. He went out and told everyone, calm down, you know, trust me, you know me, I'm here, you know, your money's safe, and it worked.
It was an uncanny moment. Yes, yeah. Absolutely. And Clive, the film shows and suggests that there were racial implications behind the charges. Why were they being singled out? Was it because they were Chinese?
I don't think it was racist in the sense that the Chinese are dishonest. I think it was the Chinese were seen as a soft touch, as Matthew said. You know, they were visibly shocked when they wouldn't cave and plead for guilty. Mm-hmm. They preferred to fight, and I think that was their undoing. Other than that, I don't think it was racist as such, as demonizing a community, but clearly it had that effect. Mm-hmm. It's interesting, Matthew talked about It's a Wonderful Life, and banking is an inherently dishonest business, which I won't go into. But what has been banking's salvation over the years is the relationships, and that's what banking always used to be based on. But that has completely gone with these mega banks. So there is no relationship. So you are dependent on the forms, whereas in a bank like Abacus, you're dependent on the relationships, and that's what their business is. And that's in stark contrast to what was going on elsewhere and being ignored.
That's a really interesting point. Did you want to add anything to that, Matthew?
There was, on the racism element, there is a very telling comment from, I think it's the DA, correct me if I'm wrong, but where he says, oh, well, no, of course we weren't racist. We didn't treat them any differently to the way we treat South American bankers or, you know, Russian bankers or, what, you know, he sort of lists another, like,
other ethnic groups.
Other ethnic groups, yeah, but doesn't, but leaves one kind of fairly major group out, white bankers, and that's the kind of fairness you'd at least expect.
I never thought my girls would work in Chinatown because we lived in Greenwich, Connecticut. Tom would be commuting every day, you know, like an hour and a half each way. So he didn't see them that much in those days. They had no idea, anything, not a faintest idea about the Chinese community. In fact, Heather still doesn't. She hates the city, you know. She's like me. We both have headaches. And at home, when we don't want them to understand, we speak Chinese.
You always said to me, if you come work for the bank, the benefit will be you have a 9-to-4 job.
9-to-4?
Because a long time ago, people could leave at 3 for the bank. He said, you can have children, you can have a family.
You know what he said to me? He said, if you wish to work with me, remember, this is your own choice. And don't think it's going to be easy. You gave me two different stories.
They're very endearing, warm family, and it makes you wonder, if any other bank CEOs are this caring. Matthew, I just wanted to ask for your brief views on the family themselves and how they're portrayed.
I think they're great. I mean, they're very entertaining dynamic between certainly the daughters and the mother. The mother's the real star of the movie, in my opinion, and she's sort of undercuts all of them with quite sort of funny comments. There's a whole sequence, a whole bizarre sequence where they're all sort of stressing about the sandwich that the father is eating and whether it's too dry and and is he enjoying it and is he sure he's enjoying it and all that sort of stuff. Yeah, you get a
real
feel.
But then it just highlights the unfairness of the situation, that there's an old man enduring this ordeal.
Yeah, he's 80. He's 75 when the prosecution begins and he's 80 when it finishes. Although I have to say, he looks pretty damn good for 80.
Yeah, not bad at all. And Clive, I'd like to talk about the wider issues now of the film. Why isn't there, I get the sense of this theme in the film, that there's a lack of accountability in the banking world. What do you make of this?
If you look at the personalities and the structures, they're all related. So the banks, in effect, control the central banks, they control the regulators, and so what appears to be wrongdoing can always be covered up. So you take the example of HSBC money laundering. They confessed. So the Department of Justice had a cast-iron case. They were lent on by a combination of George Osborne, Adair Turner, and Mark Carney, Chancellor of the Bank of England, head of the FSA at the time, and Chancellor of the Exchequer. They all sit on the Bank of International Settlements Board. So there is this web of power that sits over the financial system that actually ensures its own survival. That's why they bullied Congress into bailing out the banks in 2008, because they control
the
leaders of power.
And we saw this in our country as well. Why is there such a tight relationship between the banks and the government? Aren't the banks supposed to serve the people?
Well, it comes back to that Rothschild quote, that let me control a nation's money supply, and I care not about its laws. Simply money gives you control, particularly when you can create that money from nothing. So you can buy politicians, you can bribe politicians, you can pay people to kill politicians. So what's a politician got to do? He's got to obey orders.
There's some very hot issues you raise. But does this film evoke these sort of wider questions and raise issues about the morality of banking? Did you get that sense also from watching this documentary?
In this particular story, it's more focused on this small family and their small bank, and how, as Clive said, that this what happens to the Sung family is not related to the wider financial crisis. It's not the same, you know, the same thing. So in that sense, no. But you are very much aware of the financial crisis in the background, and certainly, like I said, the press conference that DA Cyrus Vance gives, where he gives this very sort of ebullient statement about, well, yes, we're going to be jailing these bank effect. Well, words to the effect of, we're going to be jailing these bankers, without really going into the detail. Yeah, certainly that's there.
But certainly we learn that they emerge victoriously from this, the Sung family.
A spoiler, but yes.
Yes, a little spoiler, but I think it's public knowledge sort of now that this court case has gone on. But just final thoughts now. Matthew, what's your verdict on this film and would you recommend it?
I would certainly recommend it. It's a very entertaining story. It makes you angry a little bit and it's always interesting to see film documentaries where there's a strong sense of injustice, and particularly if it ends well, then that's all for the better. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it certainly.
And final thoughts to you also, Clive. Would you recommend this documentary?
I certainly would. What spoke volumes to me is that Ken Yu, the DA star witness, was the original fraudster that was reported by the bank to the authorities, and they revoked his plea bargain at the end and charged him. Mm-hmm. And so, that tells you exactly what was going on.
I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, but just quickly.
I just wanted to add to that, actually, that really stuck out for me as well. Like, not only that, the original fraudster becomes the prosecution's star witness, which is just insane. I really couldn't understand that at all, like how that was allowed to happen. Basically, somebody who has confessed to lying and been caught lying and committing fraud becomes the star witness. Mm-hmm.
It's a very puzzling business indeed, but I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there. And we've come to the end of this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you.
In the limelight. Since 2019, more than 320 toxic substances have been detected in U.S. drinking water systems. According to a new analysis by the Environmental Working Group, EWG, a nonprofit environmental advocacy organization. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Honija Zhang, journalist. This article is published under the heading, "Hundreds of Toxic Chemicals Are Coursing Through U.S. Tap Water," new report says. Stay tuned for more. Since 2019, more than 320 toxic substances have been detected in U.S. drinking water systems. According to a new analysis by the Environmental Working Group, EWG, a nonprofit environmental advocacy organization, those harmful chemicals are linked to cancer, adverse birth and reproduction outcomes, impaired brain development, and a revolving door of other deleterious health impacts. The findings, part of the 2021 update of EWG's National Tap Water Database, underpin the call for more rigorous federal drinking water standards and the urgency to improve water infrastructure. EWG researchers collected and reviewed results from water contaminant tests conducted by water utilities and regulators from all 50 states and the District of Columbia. After coming through the data after almost 50,000 water systems serving tens of millions of American households, the researchers found sweeping drinking water contamination from numerous pollutants such as arsenic, lead, pear, and polyfluoroalkyl substances, that is PFAS, radioactive materials, and pesticides. The database offers a panoramic view of what drinking water quality looks like when the federal office meant to protect U.S. water is in an advanced stage of regulatory capture, said EWG President Ken Cook in a statement referring to the influence of polluting industries and water utilities on drinking water safety standards. Compared to the previous study's 2019 update to the database, which identified 268 chemicals in America's water utilities, the new database added 56 new chemicals. These substances are new PFAS or emerging pollutants such as pesticides and radioactive material that are currently monitored by the Federal Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, under the agency's Unregulated Contaminant Monitoring Rule. However, these substances have yet to receive any legal limits, thwarting the water system's impetus to tackle the contamination, adding to EWG. Currently, the EPA regulates more than 90 contaminants in drinking water, a fraction of the agency's inventory of more than 85,000 chemicals that fall under the Toxic Substances Control Act. The EPA's Office of Water has not added any new substances to its regulated list since 2006. Even for substances that are regulated by the EPA, their legal limits were set based on outdated science. Aloma Ike, an environmental health scientist at WG who helped construct the tap water database, told EHN, "While the EPA determines contaminants regulatory standards based on their individual harms, it fails to consider the additive effect of a chemical mixture." He said, "We are not being exposed to just one contaminant when we are drinking water. We are being exposed to multiple contaminants." The EPA's water regulations assure that public water systems are monitoring and taking actions to achieve meaningful reductions to human health risks from contaminants in accordance with the Safe Drinking Water Act, an EPA spokesperson told EHN. The agency also has evaluated a number of unregulated drinking water contaminants under the Safe Drinking Water Act and is taking actions to update its regulations, said the spokesperson. Consumers can enter their zip code into the tap water database and see a report of toxic contaminants in the area's drinking water as well as safety assessments put together by EWG scientists. In many areas, various dangerous contaminants have been uncovered in water samples, although they were still in compliance with federal health-based drinking water standards. Even if your water is below the legal limit, that doesn't necessarily mean it is safe from contaminants. Carsten Press, an environmental professor who studies drinking water contamination at Johns Hopkins University but was not involved in EWG's database, told EHN that it's great to provide individuals with more transparency about what might be in their water, because the data collected in this database are obtained from water utilities. Press cautioned that contaminants listed may not present the water quality in individual households. For instance, while the report may show the absence of lead in some utilities, certain individual households may still have lead coming out of the tap due to pollution from the water pipes. Press said that the current federal regulations aren't really directed towards protecting the consumers of drinking water, and that there has been a gap between the regulations and scientific progress. Press said there is definitely a lot of room for improvement.
Yeah, Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
I saw Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatil Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
My name is Sheikh Zaid Al-Salami.
A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. When we're talking about the social system in Islam and we're talking about social justice and the issue of how we are able to live a life of harmony, of peace, of coexistence, especially with people who we might not agree with, people who might follow a different ideology, a different religion, or maybe even people who have the same ideology, have the same religion, but might have a lesser understanding of how Islam is to be implemented in their personal lives. And of course, we need to have some kind of skill where we are able to adopt them in a good way, to not only be productive members of the society that we live in, but also set good examples as well. And something that Islam, we believe, is very clear about is condemning tyranny and oppression. And we can see that in the many cases of our imma alayhim as-salam, and also in the many cases of our esteemed ulama, there's always been that emphasis on never putting your hand in the hand of a zalim. Never putting your hand in the hand of an oppressor. Now, this oppressor might be someone ruling a government, might be someone ruling a business, a factory, or might be someone ruling a house. You know, zulm comes in many, many different ways and fashions. And I think something that I would like to work on here is when it does come to the issue of social awareness, although we need to look at it from the political side and standing against the oppressors of the world, which I think is extremely important, and I'll share some information about that from what Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli has to say, but I need to always remind myself and remind everyone around us that there's always going to be that level of vulm that we need to look at from a different angle. And that's what we need to work on as well. Vulmun nafs, where we wrong ourselves. Vulmullah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Vulmun nas. And these things could happen on a very personal level.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
You know, you could be very, very fair and just at work, but when it comes to your household, you are worse than Fir'aun. You are a zalim bima'na al-kalima, in the fullest meaning of it. You are an oppressor at home. You're smiling outside, at home you're always angry and grumpy. It could probably also be the opposite, you know, you're always smiling at home and you're always angry and grumpy on the outside. You're very fair and just at home, but you're oppressive and you're a tyrant when it comes to your business or your work or your school or your government or wherever it is that you, whatever it is that you're involved in. I think it's important for us to look at it in this particular way, because we do have many household Fir'auns around us, you know, who really are oppressing the weak in their house. You know, they are oppressing their spouse, oppressing their children and wronging them. And oppression and wronging is done in many ways. It's not only in physical abuse, domestic violence. It's probably in emotional abuse, verbal abuse, emotional neglect. You know, all these things are a part of volum as well, you know. And I think that's something that we need to look into and remember when we are talking about volm and oppression. Now, the important thing that we understand as Muslims, as far as a social level is concerned, is the rule of thumb that we have is always be against the zalim. Always stand against the zalim. Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he says, أَلَا تَرَوْنَا أَنَّ الْحَقَّ لا يعمل به وأن الباطل لا يتناهى عنه. Do you not see in the way that the Khilafah is going during the time of Bani Umayyah? Do you not see that the Haqq is not being implemented and that the Batil is not being reprehensed? ليرغب المؤمن في لقاء الله محقا. It's better off for a mu'min to meet Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It's better off for us to die. What's the point in us living if الحق لا يعمل به والباطل لا يتناهى عنه. Which is exactly why, you know, when it comes to the responsibility that we have, it's always important for us to start this from a young age, when we are more innocent, when we're more vulnerable, when we have that flaming kind of vibrant attitude towards life. We're positive about things, you know. We're not gullible. We understand what's happening, you know, and we want to work on that. We will continue on with this topic in our next episode. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children's cries.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane. And you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there, be there.
Not a day passes when the humanoid devils in Washington are not thinking of harming mankind, and not a day passes when the instruments of their terrorism are not killing people around the world, especially Muslims in Palestine, in Iraq, in Syria, and in Afghanistan. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by the staff of Kahan International. This article is published under the heading U.S. Devilry Behind Daesh Terrorism in Afghanistan. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Not a day passes when the humanoid devils in Washington are not thinking of harming mankind. And not a day passes when the instruments of their terrorism are not killing people around the world, especially Muslims in Palestine, in Iraq, in Syria, and in Afghanistan. In the last named country from which the Americans were forced to withdraw after two full decades of destruction, they are using the macabrely murderous Takfiri terrorists called Daesh, to slaughter unsuspecting men, women, and children. These satanic elements, who have no connection to Islam, even though they pose as Muslims and carry Muslim names, are the avowed enemies of Islam and Islamic unity. The prime targets of these terrorists are mosques, hospitals, schools, markets, and other public places frequented by both Sunni and Shia Muslims. Cowards by nature, the Daesh terrorists resort to remote-controlled bomb blasts, mostly by strapping U.S.-supplied explosive belts on simpletons by telling them that these are medical girths to ease bodily pains, or handing them bags filled with incendiary materials by stuffing a few notes in their pockets. The Zionist-controlled Western media wastes no time in beaming news of these wanton killings by shedding a few crocodile tears and depicting the blast as suicide operations, as if these terrorists have a cause or possess the guts to take their own life in order to